members, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We have invited three colleague committees to come and join us in the presentation that Kate Phillip from the presidency is going to make today. We invited the Committee on Labor, we invited the Committee on Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, we have invited Public Works and ourselves. The purpose is to listen to the reps from the presidency on alternative ways, on additional ways of creating jobs in the rural areas and maximizes the use of, shall I say, the engagement or the opening of space for participation of rural people into construction of roads, dams, fences, agricultural work directly in the field and other methods, and continuously engaging them instead of stop and start like we are used to. Can we find out whether all committees invited are present and see whether we can continue without them? I note that most chairpersons are not here. And the whips. And these are the people we specifically communicated with. We sort of worried, but can we get an indication how many committees are present? Thank you very much. Labour. Honorable Chabeleng was communicated with directly.
The chairperson of the Buffalo Committee on Labour confirmed this morning that he's coming with Honorable Nyakemba. Two members will be coming.
And Public Works?
I'm sorry, Chair. I didn't invite.
No. We are contrasting the extended Public Works program with this program. How would they know that they are on the right track and not if they do not understand what these people are doing? That was the original purpose. The fact that we have got Public Works members from within rural development is not the same thing as having Public Works people coming here with their chair and whip. Okay. Let's make a note of this point and move forward. Kate, welcome. Thank you very much for responding to our invitation. We know that you have been knocking at the various doors to make sure that this concept and the process is understood by everybody. This is an opportunity for these members to have an understanding of what you are doing. And we must conclude by saying, how can we collectively make sure that this program benefits the rural people we're dealing with every day. Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity. Just to explain, the presentation is broken into two parts. The first part is focused on some of the analytical work around inequality, structural inequality, and economic marginalization, and in particular, what that means for strategies of economic development in rural areas in particular. So that's the overarching context, and we'll take that first, have some discussion, and then go on to a particular strategy program that has come out of this analysis called the Community Work Program, and we'll look then at the program in more detail. So I hope that's accessible. We're doing a double whammy here, looking at two dimensions. Just by way of background, the origins of this analysis lies in what was called the Second Economy Strategy Project, which was an initiative of the Presidency based in policy NGOs called TIPS. And the framework that came out of this was approved by Cabinet in January 2009. What that process did was put the concept of the second economy and South Africa having two economies under the spotlight. And in fact, provided a critique of that notion, which I will briefly look at because it has implications for development strategy. I think we can all agree that the concept of South Africa having two economies resonated, and it became widely used because it seemed to explain South Africa's stark disparities. The problem is that in the process, it had a tendency to mask the extent to which what are inequalities in outcomes, so the stark differences between Sandton and Diepsloot, or Matatiel and Cape Town, inequalities at the level of outcomes were actually produced by common sets of processes. And that is a fundamental importance for issues of strategy, because the second economy is not poor and undeveloped because it's disconnected from the first economy. Instead, the issue is the terms of connection that are the problem. I think the best example of this is, in fact, the 1913 Land Act. Because the 1913 Land Act was not about keeping what became the Bantustan disconnected or separate. It was actually about forcing black people off the land and into urban labor markets. It was about linking them to the core economy on disadvantaged terms, and it worked. So, I think that key issue that the inequality that we see around us is not about disconnection, it is about the terms of the relationship, is it, in a sense, the key message of this presentation. And the issue is essentially about power, and it's about distribution manifested inequality. Now, the concept of the second economy has faded from fashion in recent years, but in reality, much development strategy is still implicitly based on this notion of two economies, that marginal areas, rural areas in particular, are poor and marginalized because they are disconnected rather than because of the nature of the disconnection. Briefly, in South Africa, structural inequality has its roots in key legacies of apartheid. Some of those roots predate apartheid also, like the 1913 Land Act. The critical pillars of structural inequality are the structure of the core economy, which is highly concentrated and increasingly vertically integrated. It's the legacy of spatial inequality, in particular the Bantustans and apartheid cities. These add huge economic costs within our economy, and those costs are borne disproportionately by the poor. And then probably what is best known and understood in terms of the legacy of apartheid is the history of inequality in human development and human capital formation. We can look at it like this, that inequality frames economic marginalization. Those three main pillars of structural inequality, the structure of the economy, spatial inequality, inequality of human development, add up to economic marginalization, which deepens poverty and deepens social alienation. The point being that strategies to address economic marginalization actually have to tackle these fundamental issues of structural inequality. South Africa is not a poor country. Poverty is in large part an outcome of how political power was used in very explicit ways to impact on distribution. And I would argue that addressing poverty includes the same challenge. So, in terms of this particular presentation, it's going to focus mainly on the issue of how the structure of the economy impacts on opportunities on the margin. And this is of particular importance in any debate on the revitalization of rural economies. If we don't understand how the context in rural economies today is impacted by these issues, it's very difficult to develop plausible strategies to revitalize them. I'm not going to deal with human capital issues because I think those are well understood. If we start in the core economy, I think we all know South African economy is highly centralized, capital intensive, it's dominated by a set of monopoly industries. And that this excludes more enterprise participation, it makes employment creation difficult. And there have been a set of policies that have tried to address this within the core economy. I'm not going to go through them all, I think you're familiar with them all. The main point of this presentation is to look at how these issues, competition policy, sector strategies, how the structure of the economy impacts on the margins as well, and impacts actually on the most survivalist economic activities. We tend to think that the policy issues that affect the core economy don't affect the most survivalist of enterprises, but in fact they do. The argument brings us to a key policy conundrum in South Africa, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is why is the informal and micro-enterprise sector in South Africa so small in relative terms when unemployment is so high? Why is the informal sector so dominated by retail activities? Why is there so little small-scale manufacturing? Where are services? Why are the returns to entrepreneurship so low? And why does money circulate so little in marginal local economies? These are key issues for the revitalization of the rural economy. The answers to these questions have typically focused on the following issues: the issue of skills, levels of entrepreneurship, access to credit, and I think access to capital is as important, if not more important, and issues of ease of entry, understood usually in terms of regulatory barriers. These issues do matter, I'm not dismissing them, but some of the answers to the question lies in understanding the impact of structural inequality on economic opportunity on the margins. If we look at the local economy in marginalized local economies in a rural context, markets in those areas are thin. They are thin in two respects. Firstly, in many rural areas, people are relatively more dispersed than in urban areas. But secondly, they buy a very limited basket of consumption goods because of poverty. If you look at the consumption basket of poor people, most of what is in that basket is mass-produced in the core economy at a scale that makes it very hard to compete on price, even if you take into account the cost of distance. I've got a bullet point here which says legacy of sanctions and forex control, and that might seem like a strange leap. But in fact, if you look at the South African economy, in South Africa, mining capital was not able, during the apartheid years, mining capital was not able to export its profits because of forex controls and because of sanctions. The South African mining industry is probably, I beg to be corrected, but mining industry in South Africa is probably the only mining sector in the world that reinvested its profits in bread, beer, sugar, wheat. And that has created a very unusual economic structure in the South African context. In any other place in the world, mining capital takes its profits to somewhere else in the world and invests in mining. In South Africa, Anglo and the mining industry invested in beer, sugar, maize, wheat, in the consumption goods targeting the market as a whole. Distribution systems in South Africa are efficient enough to reach even the remotest of areas. Spaza shops have Omo branding, they have Rama branding, and they have the products available. At the same time, for poor consumers, there's often a consumer preference for branded goods, sometimes for good reason. Branded goods, if you've got little money, branded goods provide quality assurance. You know what you're going to get. When you buy from an informal trader or an informally produced product, you don't always know what you're going to get. And so in terms of simple risk management, there is a preference for branded goods, but also let's recognize that advertising impacts on aspirations in every corner of the country. The net effect of all of this is that small-scale producers in rural economies have to compete in relation to price, they have to compete in relation to quality, and in relation to brand recognition. I think it's widely accepted that this is hard. I think what's less widely accepted is that in fact it may not be possible. And if it's not possible, then that has profound implications for rural development strategies, rural enterprise development strategies, and for rural local economies. I want to give you an example of a typical sewing co-op, because often we talk about the need for entrepreneurship and we don't necessarily look at the numbers. Let's say there are 20 people in this project, and they aim to earn a really modest 500 rand a month. To do that, they have to pay 10,000 rand a month in wages. If wages are 25% of the cost of the dresses that they make, with materials and other costs making up the rest of the costs, This means they have to sell dresses to the value of 40,000 rand every month just to break even and just to pay themselves 500 rand each. At 100 rand a dress, they must sell 400 dresses a month. If the group is reduced to just 5 members, they must still sell 100 dresses every month to earn 500 rand each. If they aim to earn 1,000 rand each, all of these figures must double. Now, I'm sure we can agree that 500 rand a month is not an ambitious target for this poor sewing co-op. At the same time, if you just reflect on the rural local economies with which you're familiar, in what rural local economies can they expect to sell 400 dresses a month, every month, and generate a turnover of 40,000 rand a month, every month? In a context in which, in many poor areas, Jet and Pep stores are just down the road with very competitively priced dresses, easily able to undercut the 100 rand a dress. This is the reality of the competitive situation that enterprise faces in rural areas because of the structure of the economy. What about agriculture is always the question that follows. There are local markets for fresh produce. We need to maximize them. I don't mean to dismiss the importance of these markets. At the same time, markets are thin and returns are low here also, and there is also a problem of fresh produce being dumped, I would call it, from the big commercial farms in many rural areas. Another factor here takes us back to the issue of spatial inequality, because the history of land dispossession, land degradation, coupled with rising returns to migrancy, particularly from the 1980s, resulted in major de-agrarianization of South Africa's former Bantustan areas. These figures are shocking from the labor force survey. Less than 50% of rural households engage in agriculture. That in itself is shocking. Of these, only 1.1% do so as their main source of income. Only 2.8% do so even as an extra source of income. Only 6.2% do so as their main source of food. And 87% of rural households are dependent on store-bought maize all year round. This is a picture of a de-agrarianized rural economy, and it has profound implications for strategy. The 1913 Land Act meant to make rural areas a labour-sending area for mines and industry, and it did so. It achieved it. Now the problem is that there are fewer jobs in these sectors, not enough jobs to absorb the labour force, and there's just no easy return to the land, nor is there easy access into agricultural markets for those in the rural context. Often the idea is presented as if rural people are not entrepreneurial. They sit around, they don't use their land, there's unused cropland. It's their fault. I just want to reflect very briefly on the economic rationality of this de-agrarianization, because, again, in terms of strategy, it's of fundamental importance. Firstly, it was a rational choice to invest in migrancy instead of working the land. As plot sizes diminished, productivity decreased and the returns to migrancy from urban areas increased. It was a rational economic decision in many instances. At the same time, the structure of the economy as I've described it and the mass production of agro-processed food products in the core economy means that cheap agro-processed products are available in rural areas and they raise the relative risks of own crop production. If you have to choose between buying Iwisa and growing the maize yourself, and dealing with the issues of weather and water, which affect all farmers, but also goats and unfenced livestock, which are something of a scourge, the goats in particular, in rural areas, and issues of theft. A risk analysis might lead you to buy your mini meal at the local spaza instead of growing it yourself. At the same time, the availability of cheap agro-processed products limits the scope for market entry and it disincentivizes the production of surpluses because other people are also buying the mini meal from the spaza shop. Then, where poverty is high, agriculture involves a trade-off between eating today and perhaps eating in 2 to 3 months' time. When money is in short supply and comes erratically and money comes into the household and you have to make an investment decision, do you invest in addressing the child's hunger now in the hope that things will get better next month, or do you delay that that offsetting of hunger by planting and waiting the 2 to 3 months with all the risks that are entailed. So as poverty has grown, the risks and the incentive issues around investment in production have shifted. And finally, as we all were aware, the unequal institutional development between commercial areas and the ex-Bantustan areas raises the costs and raises the risks, because there aren't storage facilities, there isn't easy access to mechanized support, all of those issues. Then we come to the issue of agricultural markets, and unfortunately, this space is taken. In South Africa, we like to learn from other countries, and that's good. The traditional approach to rural development and improving farm incomes in poor countries is to assist farmers to go up the value chain by supporting forms of agro-processing. That is a classic development model, and I think we've tried it a lot in South Africa. The first problem with this is that it assumes the production of surpluses. You can't move into agro-processing unless you're producing a surplus. But what we've seen from the numbers is that that basic condition doesn't pertain. We've seen from the numbers just how few rural households are even producing for own consumption, let alone the production of surpluses. But there's a bigger issue, or an equivalent issue as well. And that is back to the point that I have made, which is that in South Africa, a highly centralized, vertically integrated agro-processing sector already exists in relation to every key staple you care to name. And here's a list. I challenge you to find a product that is in the consumption basket of poor people that is not on this list, that is not mass-produced in the core economy, and that is not distributed at relatively cost-effective prices throughout the rural economy. And this has profound implications for the options for rural economic development. Many local economic development strategies have focused on a model that I would characterize as local production for local consumption. In many parts of the world, this makes complete sense, and it has very obvious advantages. For new entrepreneurs, they understand their own market best, and they are best placed to survive and succeed, targeting their own community with basic goods. That's why this is a very classic local economic development model. In development theory, there are debates about the core and the periphery that I won't get into, but there's what you could call an import substitution logic. If you looked at it in terms of the national economy, there's an import substitution logic to setting up local maize mills, local peanut butter co-ops, local production for local consumption. And these strategies have worked, in fact, in developing countries where no such sectors exist in the national economy and where the rural economy can supply growing unmet urban demand for fresh and processed foods. The trouble in South Africa is that the urban areas are already perfectly well supplied from within the established agricultural and agro-processing sectors. It's not as if we experience shortages in the urban areas. And rural areas are perfectly well supplied in this way also. In addition, the policy options associated with these approaches aren't available within the national economy. There are no tariffs to protect infant industries in marginal areas. There are no anti-dumping clauses. Our core and periphery exist within one economy. The problem, in fact, is that we don't have two economies. We have one economy, and marginalized areas are overshadowed, in a sense, by the strength of the core economy, its market power, and its penetration into marginal areas. But local production for local consumption is not the only development option on the table. And that's why we've seen a range of strategies that try to find alternatives because of the limits in the local production for local consumption model. Many enterprise development strategies are trying to overcome these limits by targeting external markets. And when I say external, I just mean outside the local economy. So for Matatiel, it would be Cape Town, for example. External markets. There are three main trends in this regard that I'm sure you will all recognize. The first is a focus on niche artisan products that are targeting higher value but relatively low volume external markets. This is things like the designer craft, goat's milk cheese, the rooibos tea, mushrooms, snails, essential oils. You're all familiar with these attempts for local enterprise in marginal areas to break in to external markets. The second area of strategy is trying to enter the high volume but low value commodity markets: timber, sugar, sunflower oil, beans and maize. And I'm sure here too you're all familiar with strategies that are trying to do this. And thirdly, there's strategies to try to sell to the retail giants, to try to get into the Pick and Pays and Checkers and ShopRite. There are opportunities in external markets, but accessing these markets brings new challenges and it's also hard. I think one of the key issues is that you cannot trade with external markets as an informal enterprise. Once you are trading with external markets and buyers from outside your local community, you can't rely on trust relationships. You have to rely on contracts. As soon as a transaction is no longer face-to-face, as soon as you're transacting across distance with someone you've never met, you need an enforceable contract to limit the risks of exchange for both parties. That is, in fact, the origins of contract law, is in transacting across distance. If you want to sell, you're a craft producer and you want to sell to an outlet in Cape Town, you cannot do so without the basic elements of business compliance: invoices, delivery notes, receipts, bank accounts, an address, a cell phone number. We can accuse the private sector of not supporting the informal sector by not buying from them, but the fact of the matter is that without that level of formality, a formal business cannot recognize the transaction in their books, because their auditors won't do so, and SARS won't do so. So the environment that exists is one in which if you are transacting with formal business, you need some measure of formality in order for that transaction to take place, in order for it to be recognized in the buyer's book. So the advantages of the informal sector, which are ease of access, trust relationships, face-to-face transactions, all the things that make it easy to start an enterprise in the informal sector disappear once you start to transact in external markets. You cannot do that as in the informal sector. And so, in addition, there are trends in the way the economy is structured and in value chains which require increasing levels of compliance, not with regulation, but with private standards, with certification standards, which are increasingly part of the trading environment. Very briefly, I just want to summarize current global trends in value chains because they are relevant. Firstly, the lead firms that buy in value chains are demanding higher and higher volumes. Increasingly, they tend to commission their own products rather than reselling the products of others. So the days when you make something locally and you sell it into the cities is increasingly disappearing. There's increasing concentration at the center and fewer purchase points for within the centralized value chains, which creates fewer entry points for new enterprise and small business. Many value chains are using forms of certification to reduce their costs of quality assurance, and that means high compliance requirements for the small producers. And globally, profits are moving away from production and are centered in logistics, branding, marketing, and design. All of these factors add up to a very hostile environment for small producers, but this is the environment if small producers are trying to gain a foothold in external markets and in wider value chains. Access into these external markets does have huge opportunities. If you're producing rooibos tea and suddenly the international market is open to you, that is a huge opportunity. But we need to recognize the level of challenge involved as well, because it's a step change from the small local production for local consumers, trust relations, all of that. The step change from that to accessing these wider markets is huge, and there are much higher barriers to entry. The volume requirements are part of the opportunity, they're also part of the challenge, and I've got a few examples here. In my previous life, I worked for the National Union of Mine Workers, and one of the most exciting enterprise development strategies that we embarked on involved commercializing the indigenous Marula as Ceres Marula Mania. I'm sure some of you are familiar with Marula Mania. All the Marula in Marula Mania was collected by 4,000 women in 42 villages. But that was the minimum volume requirement, required 4,000 women in 42 villages. That's a big logistical exercise. That's not just a self-start, you know, that requires a lot of investment and intermediation. Il Corte Inglés was a Spanish department store, came to South Africa, liked what it saw. They ordered 17,000 beaded bracelets in a single order to a rural craft producer. He had to mobilize 200 beaders to produce the bracelets, and he had to mortgage his house to buy the beads up front so that they could produce. Huge risk, huge capital, huge different scale of opportunity and different scale of capacity required. And then there's the example of Umgeni Beans, who made a commitment to buy from small farmers. They wanted 8,000 tons of beans. They could only secure 17 tons. The point I'm making is that it's about the step change. Once you enter into these external markets, yes, there are opportunities, but boy, the challenges are in a different league. So, if we look at what is required to enter into these wider value chains and markets, there are two key points that I want to leave you with on this. Firstly is, it requires intermediary forms of organization. Every individual producer cannot access these markets on their own, and we've seen this very strongly in the craft sector. Often, producers in marginal areas actually don't well understand the value proposition in external markets. Let's look at something like snails. I'm sure you've all heard of this project in the Eastern Cape that's exporting snails to France where they eat them. I bet you nobody in the Eastern Cape has a cultural tradition of eating those snails. The point is, if you are producing something where you don't understand the value, it's difficult to get across. It's the same in the craft sector. The design aesthetic internationally is not always the traditional one. So wherever you are targeting external markets where you are not familiar with the value proposition, you need intermediation. Now, often, development strategies have said we must cut out the middle man, and it's always a man, but in fact, in the craft sector, it's usually women. But we say, cut out the middle man. Let me tell you, you cut out the middle man, or the middle woman, and you have cut out rural producers' access to external markets in many contexts. We need to rethink that role of intermediation. Yes, the power relationship has often been negative, but there are ways of changing that power relationship. There's a group of craft producers who themselves employ a marketing agent. That's difficult. That's different from being at the mercy of a marketing agent who comes to exploit you. So the point is not to do away with intermediation. The point is to look at how do we reconfigure, how do we change the power relationships involved in that intermediation if we're going to access external markets. The other key issue is coordination. For smallholders, for example, forms of coordination are required to get to the volumes. Think of that Umgeni Beans example. You needed coordination to get to those volumes. You need economies of scale on the input side, and you need economies of scale for the kinds of infrastructure that is lacking, storage and access to mechanization and so on. Now, in many parts of the world, this is the form of co-op that works best. We have a bad history of this form of co-op in South Africa, the old white agricultural co-ops. But at a purely economic level, let me tell you, they worked very well. The irony is that this is the one form of co-op that has not been promoted in South Africa, and perhaps it's because of that history. But the emphasis in South Africa, because the urgent need is job creation, the emphasis has been on collective production co-ops in order to create jobs. They've had a terribly high failure rate. DTI's baseline study, I think, puts the failure rate, it's certainly over 86%, I think it's over 90% for co-ops in South Africa. And part of the reason for that is because so many of them have followed that local production for local consumption model. Co-op bakeries, co-op dairies, co-op piggeries, co-op, they're competing with the core economy and they can't do it. But the one form of co-op that has had very little support and traction is the agricultural user co-op, supply co-op, input supply, coordination between. And I think in the discourse there's also been a bit of a negative approach towards individual producers, but in agriculture often people farm as families, as households, and mechanisms of coordination, building the coordination required to get to the levels of volume and scale, economies of scale, to make these enterprises viable is a crucial part of the challenge. So what I'm saying is that we need to rethink this middleman issue, we need to think about intermediation, and we need to think about strategies of coordination. At the moment, the strategies of coordination are primarily coming from above. So the sugar sector sets up the outgrower schemes, the timber sector, but it's the core industry that is driving it. Where are the strategies for coordination from below, which are able to change the Very briefly, I'm going to look at evidence from urban areas that illustrate some of these wider arguments. This is the most in-depth work on small enterprise in Gauteng that has yet been done. It was the Finmark survey in 2006. I want to make quite a simple point. They used a model which is called the business sophistication model. On the far left, you're on the pavement, you don't have a cell phone, and you don't have the same spot on the pavement 2 days in a row. Okay, you are as marginal as it gets. Those are the guys on the far left. On the far right, and this is enterprises up to 200 employees. On the far right, they are VAT registered, they've got their own premises, they're fully formal sector. I'm sure you can see this incredible leap from, it's called BSM 1 on the left and BSM 7 on the right. I'm sure you can see this incredible leap. It's a leap in many different respects. In this one, it's showing the number of jobs that are created. And what we're seeing is that actually job creation is coming from the more formal end of the spectrum, if we're serious. This shows turnover. Sorry, I scrunched the words there. This is turnover per annum, and it's terribly depressing. Because even with a 20% profit margin, in BSM 6, which is right up, nearly at the top end, people are earning only about R1,000 a month if they've got a 25% profit rate, and most don't. And yet the returns escalate dramatically once you get into BSM 7. It's easy to look at this and to say, well, clearly our strategy is to take all these people who are down at the bottom end and formalize them into the top end. And some of government strategies, I think, have been trying to do that. But there's a problem. All those guys from BSM 1 to BSM 5 are in retail. The overwhelming majority are in retail. And if you're a street trader or you're running a spaza shop, formalizing is not going to help you to go up the ladder. Because the formal retail industry already dominates that space. And in fact, they're busy coming down the ladder. Statistics are showing that they are eroding the space for informal retail. So it's not a simple issue of taking those guys on the left and moving them up to the right. The other key feature that differentiates what's on the left from what's on the right speaks to what I've been saying. Because actually it's not just a shift in formality, it's a shift in the nature of the business. On the right there, they are involved in business-to-business transactions, they're involved in value chains. These are the guys who are accessing the external markets. On the left are the informal ones, local transactions, mostly in retail. So it's not formalization per se that's driving the opportunities on the right. It's actually, I'm arguing, the difference in where they are inserted into markets, that they are managing to break into these wider markets. This leads to a tension in small enterprise strategy, and this argument was about the urban context and street traders, but it applies as much in the rural context. Which is that there are no particular benefits to formalizing for informal traders who are involved in direct transactions. But the fact is that there is limited scope for growth without formalization for SMEs who are trying to break into wider markets and value chains. There's just no escape from meeting basic standards and business practices and complying with a whole set of regulations and standards. And it's not actually even regulation that's the main issue. If you can't fill out a UIS form, then frankly, you're unlikely to be able to survive the other compliance requirements of transacting into the supermarkets, for example, the kinds of certification that's required to participate in these wider value chains. The ability to comply unlocks opportunities and is a necessary condition for access to external markets, and that's where the growth potential is. Unfortunately, this is quite a depressing story in many respects. If I can just summarize, and we're coming to the end of this first section of the presentation. The argument here is not that there are no opportunities, but understanding what they are and what they aren't is what should drive strategy. Most unfortunately, the structure of the economy means that there are real structural limits on the local production for local consumption model, the classic LED model, that wonderful vision we all have of at the local level people produce their own milk and sell it to the local bakery and sell it to the... That lovely vision, the structure of our economy makes it pretty much impossible. There are some opportunity for services, for example, the taxi industry, but the fact of the matter is that without a small manufacturing sector in the local economy, the scope for business services is constrained. And that's why in South Africa, our service sector in rural areas and in the informal sector is dominated by personal services. There isn't a strong component of business services. The reality in our context is that the simplest entry point into markets involves moving cheap branded goods from the core economy to the margins. That is the entrepreneurial opportunity. People on our informal sector is not dominated by retail because people aren't entrepreneurial. Our informal sector is dominated by retail because we have entrepreneurs who understand that that is the only opportunity. And that's why the retail sector dominates the informal sector, because of the structural constraints at other levels. The difficult conclusion that this means, that this brings, is that there is no easy entry into markets from below. There is little scope for poor people to self-employ their way out of poverty, and yet many of our strategies have assumed that they can do so. With a little bit of microcredit, a little bit of skills development, a little bit of entrepreneurship, they can back up and employ their way out of poverty. If the arguments I've presented here are accurate, then that is an unreasonable expectation, and that has profound implications for strategy. The opportunities that do exist require access into higher value and higher volume external markets, and that requires a step change in levels of formality, access to capital and compliance. It requires strategies of coordination and intermediation. It requires much more support, much more intervention, much more skill, and all of those things. So what does this mean for strategy? At an overall level, strategies need to focus on addressing structural inequality. I made this presentation to the National Planning Commission, and what I've argued is that if they drop this ball, who is going to pick it up? Because addressing structural inequality is a big long-term agenda. I don't know exactly how we're going to do it, to be honest. It's a tough one. But we can't just neglect it. We can't solve these problems without tackling the issues of structural inequality in a very serious way. The new growth path does start to try to do that, but certainly more policy attention is needed in this area. At the same time, strategies need to focus on the scope for change within the current market structure. We've got the economy we've got. We can't just wait for structural change before we do anything. And the critical issues, I would argue, that need to be addressed in the more immediate term is what are the instruments available to tackle concentration in the economy? Competition Commission is doing a good job, but does it need more power to its elbow? What are the instruments that allow us to change the distribution of power and profits in value chains? Because that is a critical distributive issue. Then this issue of new forms of intermediation. How do we think differently, look differently at bridging the gap between producers in marginal areas and the opportunities externally, and think in different ways about the power relationships involved in that intermediation role? And what role for forms of coordination that consolidate volumes and create economies of scale? How do we trigger those? How do we enable those? How do we incentivize those? And not make collective production a necessary condition for that form of co-op, but actually embrace small producers of different kinds. Finally, and this is the emphasis of the discussion in the next section, structural change is going to take time. The other change processes that I've spoken about, accessing wider value chains, will still exclude many of the poor. complementary strategies that enable economic participation even where markets don't. How we do that is the focus of the second half. It's not as long, trust me. It's not as long. But how we do that, how we develop strategies that enable economic participation even when markets don't, is the second part of the discussion. My suggestion, though, is that we break here for discussion on the implications of this first analysis, which is focused mostly on market, on creating employment in the market context, and what limits and possibilities are.
Thank you, Chair. Just a few remarks. Thank you very much, is it Mrs. Philip, for this very comprehensive and thorough investigation that you've done, research or whatever the case may be. I find it very, very informing in the first place, but not only informing, but I think the reality out there. And coming from the agricultural sector, I can absolutely see what is happening. And that is, I want to just point out a few of these trends that has happened in South Africa. Markets was always our constraint. Without markets, we cannot grow the sector. And as you've explained, the markets brings standards, quality control, all those things that needs to go with it. And on top of it, we're also competing internationally. So we're not only competing in our own country, but we're also competing internationally. And if we want to export, we need to then supply the volume, supply the quality, be consistent in those efforts. The primary agricultural sector, as we knew it, and you referred to the corporations, obviously the co-ops in South Africa was a primary situation. It was not involved in most instances, not involved in value-adding systems. It transformed. It played a very, very good role, and I think there's still a place for, especially for the small-scale farmers to enroll themselves into small cooperatives, and that is why the cooperative system has also been changed to make it possible for smaller groups to become in a cooperative. But I'll add to it just now. But I think what we've seen in South Africa is precisely the reason why this business model that we had in South Africa was not conducive to expand the numbers of producers. It was actually doing the opposite. It was reducing the number of farmers out there. Specifically also for the reasons that you pointed out, that for the profitability of the sector, people had to go bigger. Because of the small profit margins, the high risk involved, and everything else on that. So we've gone down from 120,000 farmers in South Africa in the 80s to less than 40,000 commercial farmers at the moment. And I think if we must be very careful in the models that we put together, not to try to swim upstream in the economic model, because the economic model in South Africa is conducive to what we have. And you're quite right, we will have to think outside that model. But in other words, we will not... The local markets, let me just start with that. I think the local market is full. I think, informal markets, you can't really expand it. There's not much more people that can enter in it. But we will have to go the way of adding value. And if you want to add value, then you have to create a model for that. And I think that is one of the things that you possibly will tell us in the second part of it. One thing that I would like to point out, and I think you've mentioned some issues on the degraded land in the former independent state, which is not really the truth. We sit in South Africa with high potential land in Transkei, for instance, and the Ciskei. They got the rainfall, the quality of soil and whatever we haven't got in the rest of South Africa. You know, there are only two provinces really in South Africa with high potential land, and that is Mpumalanga and the Eastern Cape. But the Eastern Cape side is in the former Transkei. So we've got that type of facility we've still got, so we can expand production tremendously by just making use of that. On the other hand, also we can create land that can be used and that we can improve to produce whatever we want. I mean, these days they produce in the deserts of Cairo or actually next to in Egypt with desalinated water and sand. They produce enough food for themselves. But the point I want to make, the limit is not the land. The limit is not the land, but the morals that we have to do. So I think from my side, I find it very, very interesting, and I think we should take note of what is said here. And I think the big problem in the past was the model of the small-scale farmer swimming upstream, not being able to compete in the markets, not really having an access to the markets, and that is one of the things that we will have to do and to solve the problem from our side. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. My take will be the constraints of the market for the small farmer. I talk from a fishing experience, from the small-scale fishing, subsistence fishing experience. The access of the market is a constraint for the small players because they do not have capital interest, capital access. That's the first one. There is no infrastructure for them. Ownership, whether it's land, whether it's infrastructure, it's the ownership that is a constraint and a bottleneck. Access to capital, access to markets. So the market access comes from, in the first place, it's limited access to capital. And the small farmers, small fishers, have the very, very, very same percentage of interest they must compete while they do not have the benefit of the ownership of having their own land, their own capital, their own model. The model was never transformed to suit the small farmers, to suit the small fishers. Never ever, it was not transformed. And that is where it did not start, to give them access to the market. It's where it did not start, to give them access, to give value to the products they are throwing. By saying that, we do not even know, from where I'm sitting, I don't really know, what are the products brand from the smallholder? Nobody give it to us. It is not marketed very well. It is unknown. I really don't know what are the products we eat or buy from smallholder, because it is suppressed. That's the second one. I want to go also to there are no pages here, but okay. Where the implications for strategy is more policy attention. I want to say I'm so allergic for that one. Every time when we must empower the poorest of the poor, we must shape now the policy, and now we must start to shape the market. Why? There are products from small producers. There are. We must strengthen the local market. Because if we can strengthen the local market, because there is no way in heaven the smallholders are going to get access now in this decade to the external market. No way. Because it is already stifled, or say, mochi. bottleneck, panic gating is that you won't come into this market. We are already here. I'm telling you, I'm talking out of experience. So for me, it's strengthen. There must be a strategy to strengthen the local market so that we can market the products of the smallholders. We grew up farming. In Tony, what will make us now not know what is the value? We do know what is the value. It's because we are given this hips and big elephant in front of us, and then people are afraid because they heard no, there are problems. They hear there are problems because they do not have the money. It's risky now to take the little bit that I have and put into this investment because I will lose my money. So there must be a way out of this. There can't be bottleneck and policy gaps. There are no policy gaps. We must just go to DTI and say, you, the model must be able to give the first thing, the capital access and the access to land and ownership. That three. I guess. That's all the expert.
Sugar sugarcane growers. But you know, instead of these people getting richer, they are getting more poorer, because there's one mill that is dictating the price, you know, for them. You know, out of the profit that they are getting, you know, there should be a deduction of the transport costs. They have to pay loans, they have to pay employees. At the end of the day, they remain with nothing. I think it's one of the reasons. With regard also to those who are trying to be broiler farmers, because the industry is dictating for them how much are they going to pay for one, you know, for one chicken. While they are spending a lot of money buying these chicks, you know, buying the feed, feed them, you know, at the end of the day, they get nothing. But due to the red tape, as you have indicated, there are also more red tapes, you know, the issue of accessing loans, the issue of the market, there are many vegetable farmers in rural areas, but where do you sell them? Because Spy has got, you know, some people far away at a distance that are supplying them with vegetables, while in the rural areas we've got a lot of vegetable gardens. Even our hospitals are failing even to support, you know, those small farmers, so that at the end of the day they go from being small farmers to being commercial farmers. I think I agree with some of the issues that you have raised here, the rated, the formalities, you know, these forms that are written in English. Why people are illiterate, they can't fill them. At the end of the day, you know, they go to those offices and end up being discouraged and just, you know, leave everything. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. I think this is a very informative research. I agree with most of the points that are there. But as my colleague said, finances are a major problem. And also, you cannot have a situation whereby you finance people with high interest rates, especially with agriculture. History repeats itself. According to history, in 1948, when the Afrikaner took over, they financed people at low interest rates, and there were subsidies. Now, if you don't subsidize your small farmers, that is suicide, and that is what is happening. And I also agree with you with co-ops, that these co-ops don't have to work in silos. They have to work together. But there's also going to be a protection. There's a lot of dumping, especially in the former Eastern Cape. Not only local dumping, from international companies. That is uncontrollable, totally uncontrollable. That also destroys the smaller kind. You would remember, Chairperson, before our government took over with these TPV states, some of them used to have their own milling companies, and they were sustainable. There was no problem with those milling companies. The social grant system also affects our people. It has caused and made them lazy. Let us be fair also. There is a lot of land out there, especially in the East Cape. I agree with the Honorable Bosman. But most of the land is communal land. And people who used to be self-sufficient, they used to plow every year. I used to work in Joburg Chambers. I didn't have to buy any groceries. All I had to buy is some brandy for my people and for my chiefs, as usual. You know that normally when you go home, you carry some. That's all I had to do. So let us be very clear here. Social grant system destroying us. Secondly, protection. The dumping that is happening there. You get sheep from New Zealand. You get all the type of dumping that's being dumped, especially in these rural areas. So it means that these co-ops will never survive. And then you need financed with a low interest rate, with a zero interest rate for them to survive. vaccine, and then you also need a subsidy system. Europe, they subsidize their farmers. Why can't we subsidize our small farmers? We need to bring in that system for them to sell, or else they'll never get out of it. 500 rand a month is better. Some of them are even getting 200 rand a month. So that is why they prefer rather to go for the social grant than going to do farming. So I 100% agree with you, but we need to change our policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Kate, for this information. You know, to address the economy of our country, South Africa, always it is difficult because it is between the have and the have not, which were created by the old system. And we must know that here, mostly, this poverty, the marginalized people, are the rural masses. And these people, they are struggling every day of their lives. Firstly, they did not have land in the past. As all we know, that the 1913 Act took the 87% of the land and leave 13%, very, very little for black people. And even today, to readdress the history of this country, really, it will take us, I think, years to put things on balance. You know, the rural masses, because I'm from the rural, those people, they struggle on daily basis. They don't have roads. They don't have land. Even those who are crying, they don't have market. They don't have transport, even to transport those small onion things they are producing. And that's why I'm saying, to talk about the economy. Yes, you can say the economy is one. It was supposed to be one. But as we are speaking, it needs a proper strategy and cool minds to implement that strategy to address these things. If really we don't do that, we will remain with the poor rural masses becoming poorer and poorer and poorer. Because when things are everything, the price are it was striking up. The most people who are suffering are the rural poor masses. And what I can say, you know, sometimes things are so good on paper, but if you know these things can be addressed and implemented, then it will be big, you know, to talk. It's long we've been talking, you know, it's long, and now we need action. Action must take place so that really our rural masses can see what we call better life to them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Yagamba from the Control Committee on Labor. Also a rat boy. Never mind. I think let me join colleagues in welcoming the presentation. I think it's informative, and it's also identifying challenges. And the part that I like the most is the reference to the 1913 Land Act, which then limited people in terms of using land, because then the land was taken away from them. And I think when you talk of the policy changes, my thinking is that you are looking at that, how to change that around, which I think the department is trying to deal with that. The programs is to say that does not necessarily depend in the retail sector. First, we need to go back the way that we used to live. That's why I even forget that I'm a man. I'm still thinking the time when I was a boss. I want to speak on the co-ops. It is not difficult to form co-ops if you look at the legislations within the Department of Trade and Industry. The challenges that have been raised by colleagues here, in a way, Department of Trade and Industry is trying to deal with those. Like the agency called Small Enterprise Development, which is there in order for capacitation of those co-ops and other enterprises that might, wherever how small they are. And also, I think I will take CEDA as one of the middlemen or women that we're talking about, that instead of looking to those who will try by all means to milk those cooperatives that are supposed to get in the market, at least we rather utilize CEDA, which will facilitate and capacitate those cooperatives. That's what I think linked to that within DTI's chair. There is what is called cooperative incentive schemes that assist in terms of equipment that might be required by those co-ops, be it co-ops on agriculture or in whatever way. So I think the presentation, in my view, and the program that the department has, if we can also incorporate the programs and plans which the Department of Trade and Industry has, I think we can, in a way, see some kind of movement trying to get off the ground. So I wanted to just to raise those few issues, Chair. Welcoming the presentation, it does give some kind of how are we supposed to move, how can we take the experiences that have been raised and link it with them with the current progress. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks for the good presentation, Ms. Phillips, Kate Phillips, Dr. Phillips. Philip here. Very good presentation indeed. And it takes me a little bit back, you know, like looking at the Land Act and generally looking at the apartheid and its laws. The laws were driven by race and class. In South Africa, it becomes very difficult to draw a line between race and class. There's a very thin line. And there were people who some comrades defined apartheid as ruled by monopoly capital. the open race terror. But at the core of the poverty now and the problems we have, it's the land issue. The 15% that was left in the hands of the majority, it's marginal land. You can't do anything with that land. And when I grew up in Skukuneland, there used to be some forest here and there, you know, the bushes. But now, Skukuneland has become a desert. The quality of the soil, you can't plant anything on that. To plant something, you need to get compost, manures, and you actually need to spend lots of money to get a blade of grass, 10 blades of grass to grow on that land. Who has that money in the first place? And if you look at most projects, gardening projects in my village, in Skukuneland, the projects will only work when they get money from social development. And when the money ends, the project stops. Because there's nothing you can produce on that land. It's actually a waste of money. Our money. Of course, you've already talked about the sowing project, you know. Most of the sowing projects are I've worked with women's projects in the farm of. Those old ladies, they buy their clothes at church, and they buy their children's school uniforms at Woolworths. And still they are making these uniforms, so-called school uniforms for children, but their children are not wearing those clothes. So who is going to buy these clothes? The projects are only there when there is cash. Once the money dries out, the projects are gone. I think we need to look at other things for rural development, for rural areas, other than communal gardens, because they don't work. Let's go beyond scratching the land for some. And I mean, it's not only the questionnaire, the quality of it's not only the quality of the soil, but I think the changes in the global, you know, the global warming too. You can't literally say that it's going to rain in April this time, you know. Because when you plant, what you plant is informed by the season, and at the same time the seasons are linked to the rain, to rains in the villages. In my village, when it gets cloudy on the eastern side, everybody knows it's going to rain. But this time it can be cloudy on that part of the village for days, without not even a single drop of rain. So there are lots of things that are impacting on development of rural economies, which makes us to go beyond the given to be much more creative when we're looking at matters of rural development. I missed the first part of the presentation because I did an early meeting in my office. Thank you very much.
Honorable members, thank you very much for your comments. And Kate, you want to deal with the answers now, or do we take a break and then you deal with those, then you make the last bit of your part two contribution?
Okay,
briefly,
if I can respond very briefly to some of the issues and then I think one of the first points was about strengthening the local markets, and I think you may be interested to see in the next session how that issue is picked up. The issue of the 87% store-bought maize and whether the Department of Agriculture programs are having an impact, I don't know that. But it would be a very interesting thing to get data on. We would have to do a comparison between the labor force survey that this was based on and more recent studies. This laziness issue, I want to take issue with because I think it often underestimates the structural constraints. I do think that those structural constraints in turn impact on people's sense of agency. And when you've had structural constraints over decades, I think people lose their belief in their own ability to change their circumstances. So it is an iterative, interlinked process. But I think the laziness issue perhaps often underestimates the depth of the structural issues. So the example, for example, of the sewing co-op and those kinds of initiatives where they do only survive if there's money because market factors are against them. They can't compete with Jeff. It's not about laziness. It's about the competitive context. The issue of the Chinese shops and the cheaper goods, I mean, I think this is the fundamental point, is that the strategies we embark on can't ignore the competitive context. I mean, maybe it means that we shouldn't be allowing those, you know, it's about trade policy, it's about those kinds of issues. I'm not going to go there, it's not my area, but I think the critical point is that we can't ignore the competitive context when we look at what strategies will work. So there is no point setting up lots and lots of sewing co-ops to produce uniforms when they are cheaper at Jet's, because the fabric is actually also owned by a monopoly. The company that produces the uniforms also produces the fabric, and so they have a competitive advantage over those small co-ops. Then there are risks in external markets as well. The issue of the sugarcane growers getting nothing and being exploited in those value chains. This issue of the distribution of power in value chains is a critical issue also. So it's not just about getting access into those markets. The same with the supermarkets. The way small producers complain about how they get screwed in that relationship. So it is about power. It's about power and the distribution of returns are critical issues. I agree with the issue of finance and that finance is a problem. But the second part of the question is finance for what? I think there has been a tendency to provide, for example, microfinance to do the kinds of things that don't work. So yes, access to finance is an issue, but finance for what is the key issue. And of course, the land question is a critical part of the spatial inequality that I would see as the overarching structural inequality issue that needs to be addressed. And finally, I do have great sympathy for the frustration of one of the colleagues here with endless talk of policy. And I think that this next section is a response to exactly that frustration, because it's about, so what do we do now in the short term that can make an impact? Perhaps the strategy that was prioritized might not have been the strategy that she would have chosen, but it is an attempt to say, actually, all these policy changes are important, but they will take time, and we don't have time. We have an unemployment crisis and a poverty crisis. What are we going to do to address that in the short term? And that is a different way of looking at this question that's posed here. How do we enable economic participation even when markets don't? And so maybe on that note, if I can continue into the next section, Chair. But, okay. So, what we've looked at is structural inequality.
Contributed their one day's wages. Now, that chair has been able to assist in a number of areas. 40,000 jobs created, but the majority of those jobs are collapsing. Why? Because in the very many areas, in the rural areas, you have the farms that have been given to a number of workers. They own those particular farms, but then those farms are collapsing. And I want to believe that that will be the case. We will say that many people must have farms, they must have animals, they should be able to take this to the grow them and so on and so on. But then they are still not going to succeed. I mean, exactly what you are raising. They won't succeed unless we do something and tell us what needs to be done. Because again, it comes to this issue of access. Yes, they will grow cattle, etc. But then, where are they going to compete? Because if the rich farmers, etc., will be able to get access to, for example, ShopRite Checkers, to Pick and Pay, etc., etc., then these poor people will not be able to take any anywhere except to just produce and slaughter back at home. And that will not create any jobs altogether. If the through you chair, she can be able to respond to that, that will assist. But secondly, chair, I know I'm taking in, going into your time. If she kindly, as she goes on, tell us who must be responsible, number one, for the evaluation that things are running properly, those smaller farms, for example, agricultural areas, who is going to evaluate, who is going to monitor? Because your chair will say that where I come from, in the DLR, for example, let people, 100 of them, be given some farms. But who is going to monitor and make sure that there is success? Because they may just lie there and nothing altogether will happen. And the last chair, I've gone through the document that the, I think it's the Department of Labor they came up with. And there is a point where, just to quote from there, visitors are talking, really, let me not go far, they're talking about the going down in terms of the job creation. And if you check there, the section that goes down even more is the one around agriculture. It has been given, you know, quarter to quarter, one would quote those particular figures if there was time. But then it is going down and down and down. So you say we create jobs, but then the next quarter you check, it goes down. Next quarter, it goes down. And the according to the research given here, for example, it was 71 in the first quarter. It went down to 59 second quarter, 45 third quarter, and so on. All right? So we commit ourselves here today and say that we are going to do create these jobs a chair through our able leadership, but then it is still going to be a problem. Now, how do we please respond to that as you go on with the second part? How do we monitor? How do we evaluate? How do we assist and make sure that we stabilize the whole thing? I gave you an example and said that the Labor Job Creation Trust, which one actually chaired for 10 years, was able to create those particular farms, etc. But then it as well is going down because of the market. That is a major problem. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. We're going to shift gear a little bit with this next section. section, so I'll just very quickly address the issues there. I mean, I think the examples of the 40,000 jobs that were created and that then were lost illustrates exactly what the presentation is trying to speak to, is that I have seen the review of the Job Creation Trust, and my sense is that many of those jobs were in projects that fitted this local production for local consumption model, that were trying to create jobs through things like sewing co-ops and bakeries and dairies, targeting local markets, and that the competitive factors, because of the structure of the economy, made those unviable. Many of the agriculture projects that have failed, it's the same set of issues that have been addressed here, which is that they can't compete. Ownership is part of it, access to finance, all of these things matter. But in a sense, there's almost an over-determining issue, which is the competitive context, which makes it very difficult for people to break into those markets. I can't comment on who should review these things, and I'm not familiar with the Department of Labor figures, although I think the decline in employment in agriculture is also an indicator of this wider issue of competition in the agriculture sector. What I'm going to shift to now is this issue of enabling economic participation even where markets don't. Everything we've discussed so far has been about the frustrations of creating employment in a context of structural inequality, where a combination of the structure of the economy and the history of spatial inequality and the history of inequality of human development all combine to make that extremely difficult. In sum, structural inequality places real constraints on the scope for employment from below in South Africa, and that's a difficult pill to swallow. At the same time, however, in a country with chronic structural unemployment, we have a situation where the unemployed have almost no social protection. We talk about the social grants, and we do have a very good and strong social grant system. But I think we need to recognize that social grants at present cover those who the society does not expect to be economically active. The child support grant is meant for the child. The fact that it may get used for other purposes is a different issue, but the child support grant is meant for the child. The mother can't starve. If the mother starves, that's not good for the child either. But the child support grant is meant for the child. The pensions are meant for people who are too old to work. And the disability grant is meant for people who are not expected to work, who aren't able to work. And yet the discourse in South Africa is one in which we seem to be surprised that those who get social grants don't become economically active, even though the fact that they can't become economically active is the reason they're getting a grant. For the unemployed, only 3% are covered by UIF at any one time. The fact of the matter is that there is no form of social protection support for unemployed, able-bodied adults other than that 3%. And I want to make the point that young men are particularly vulnerable and disempowered. This is a gender issue. The young women do have some access, if they have children, they do have some access to income support through the child support grant. They have some money that they control, that they don't have to ask anybody except the state for. But young men actually don't have that. They are completely dependent on goodwill transfers from other people, either from people who are earning wages or from people who are getting social grants that are actually intended for other purposes. The fact of the matter is that workers and the poor are providing this private safety net. Who is it that unemployed people depend on? On the whole, it's poor households. It's people who are employed in poor households. That is a factor raising wage pressures in our economy. People complain about workers asking for higher wages, but don't always take into account who it is that's supporting the unemployed in the current context. And it's people getting social grants in poor households who are having to share that to support unemployed people. That's pushing households deeper into poverty, and it's making inequality worse because it's the poorest. Statistically, it's the lowest two income deciles who support, the majority of unemployed people are from the lowest two income deciles, which means that the poorest people in society are carrying the burden of unemployment. There was a debate about big, and certainly a grant would help, but the argument that's made here is that it's about more than the money. Let's just look at our context. In our context, more than half of the unemployed under 35 have never worked. But it's well established that people who lose their jobs become increasingly unemployable because they lose the skills of work. How much more is that the case for people who've never worked, who've never learned the skills of work? We also know from statistics that those who have never worked are least likely to succeed in self-employment. So we've treated self-employment as an alternative to unemployment, but people who've never worked don't have the skills to make self-employment work. In addition to all these market factors we've been talking about, here's this additional thing. For many people in our society, the link between work and remuneration is simply missing because they've never experienced it. They are relying on other people to support them. Sociologically, this has profound implications because being economically productive is part of a transition to adulthood. The transition from being a child to being an adult is about being able to provide for yourself, your family, your parents. It's a crucial part, sociologically, of the transition to adulthood. The structural dependence that I described in the first section has influenced people's sense of their economic agency. We're a society that transformed itself from apartheid to a democracy through political agency. And yet, economic agency has not been unlocked. We have large numbers of people who are simply excluded from economic participation and who have lost the belief in their ability to change their material conditions through their own actions. This is a profound sociological crisis. It's an economic crisis, but it's also a profound sociological crisis. And I argue it's a crisis of the meaning of work in the society. We're actually seeing the erosion of work skills on a systemic scale, and what that means for the future is hard to tell. This was a context in which a new form of public employment was initiated out of the same strategy process that I've been describing. The community work program was initiated and piloted as part of the Second Economy Strategy Project, and it was a response to these issues. And it was also a response to the review of phase one of EPWP. And one of the points in that review was that too many people were exiting back into poverty. And there was a tendency to blame EPWP for that, but actually that wasn't fair, because EPWP couldn't control whether people who exited got jobs, because the question of whether they got jobs was a question of whether there were jobs. If the economy was not creating jobs, it was very difficult for EPWP to ensure that people who exited got jobs. So CWP was designed as a complementary form of public employment, not instead of anything that EPWP is doing. In fact, it's officially part of EPWP now as a new component. But it was designed in a different way from the other components. It was designed to be an employment safety net, intended to provide people with access to a minimum level of regular part-time work, particularly in marginal areas where jobs are unlikely to come anytime soon. And it was particularly a response to the recognition that unemployment is deeply structural. It's not going away soon. So what CWP offers is 2 days of work a week on a regular basis. Now, why 2 days of work a week? Well, firstly, you know, negotiating full-time work for everybody on an ongoing basis from Treasury might have been hard, but there are better reasons. The point was that regular work provides participants with structure in their lives. One of the features of unemployment is the lack of structure. So 2 days of work a week means regular economic participation. It provides an earnings floor that's ongoing. So instead of 3 months of full-time employment and then nothing, CWP is 2 days a week over the whole year. It comes to the same amount. EPWP's target is 100 days. Is a work opportunity. In CWP, 2 days of work a week is 100 days, but it's spread over the year. What that does is it provides a consistent earnings floor. So instead of a short-term spike in income, people know they can rely on at least the income from 2 days of work a week on a consistent basis. The other key point is that it doesn't displace existing livelihoods, and the intention is that it should actually enable them by giving people some income security, their potential to invest, to take risk, to engage in productive activity is enhanced. I'm not going to talk more now. I'm going to go to the DVD, which will tell you much more about the program. Just very quickly to clarify, the DVD is a year old, and so the figures are a little bit out. The daily wage rate is now 60 rand a day. That's the ministerial determination from the Department of Labour. And the total number of participants by March 2011 was 89,000 people, actually 99, you can say 100,000, rounded off, if you include the sites funded by Gauteng Province. So now we're going to just watch the DVD and let it do the talking.
Spent. In Gippsluit, a month-long organizational work workshop issued web contracts to community groups. By April 2010, there were 49 CWP sites across South Africa. We'll show you some of the work that's happening at these sites. First, let's take a look at projects that improve infrastructure.
Unemployment is very high because the mines closed down. People are retrenched. We have skilled people. There's about 10 plumbers on the project who help with the maintenance of the leaking pipes, the stormwater channels in the community.
With the skills that I have, I had wanted to say, in a way, contribute back to the community that I come from. And then it was in the CWP where I got the platform to do so. I was able to transfer some of the skills that I possess as an individual to the greater community.
What we are doing here, we are constructing the road. The soil here is very bad. We're taking out the soil, we're digging about half a meter deep, and then we lay this granite slabs first as a basement, and then on top we lay this chlorite material. When it is raining, it is very nice to dry out on it.
In this sewer, the participants decided to renovate Paradise Primary School. This work was done through community-based contracts.
Here we have an old toilet that used to service the school, and we have now contracted the team to build newer toilets, a bigger toilet.
Education is an important focus in all the communities. The CWP helps provide solutions in many ways, from teaching to construction.
We have a school support program where we actually use matriculants to support the teachers in class, and then after school we have a program where we start the kids teaching them to read and write and also help them with their homework. We also change the security system at the schools, where we make security available so that you can actually address the whole issue of drugs in the schools.
In many communities, improving the safety of children is a priority. So are social services like child care. The CWP supports crashes, and this has resulted in reduced cases of rape because kids are not left at home. And community members who have helped build gardens, make food for the crashes, assisting in health nutrition. Through community mapping and information gathering, the CWP can help identify the areas where support is needed. The CWP supports local economic development through community services like this St. Lucia Community Tourism Center and by improving infrastructure. The community of Bushbuck Bridge is building a bridge. They have the support of the local municipality and other partners. This bridge will improve access for local residents and for tourists who generate significant income for people here. intensity of at least 65%. So for every 100 rand that is spent, at least 65 rand goes towards wages. For big projects like building roads or bridges, partnerships are key. We provided some equipment as a municipality to assist that community, but also in turn, that community or the project itself, it also assisted the municipality in other areas where we needed them. So we think that the partnership will continue to grow from strength to strength. HIV/AIDS and TB are still the biggest health challenge in South Africa. Sick people don't have access to care, and caregivers are mainly family, which can be a huge burden.
Of the program is to provide an employment safety net. Community
communities have also used it to address development issues like HIV/AIDS. Infrastructure, education, local economic development, food security, the environment, and community safety.
Overcome this
very huge challenge that was created by the negative past. Because I know of an agency that were doing research while the mines were still active in the Northern Cape. They were doing research, feasibility studies with their capital, of course. And there was a very good product they have come up with to the very local municipalities of the area. That information that they were giving us was, I was fortunate, lucky to go and be part of that meeting. It was during the recess. What I have seen there, it was able to give more than 1 million, create more than 1 million jobs, with capital not coming out of government coffers. It is just this part of the country. We were talking 1 million jobs, and they were showing us, and we know the area. But what I don't sense out of this research, did you go that far, or were you just focusing on what government can do in PWP? Because that program was showing us the infrastructure, it's very old, but how they can give life to new infrastructure. They were showing us the agro processing opportunities in the area that we also know that it can be a reality. Because it's those projects that you have shown in your previous slides that did not work because of those different challenges and constraints and red tapes. Now my worry is this just focusing on the coffers of government? Because it will never work if it is that. That's what I also want to say. It will work if other parties that have created this negative legacy come on board and redress that they have made damage of in the past years that when they were governing. So just give me that clarity. Otherwise, it was very informative and worrying. For we are still going to create models, structure. It will take time, but we cannot go with 2 days work, 8 days in a market. It is frustrating people. It can't work like that. There are people who want to come to the party, and I would like really to know, are you engaging those and go and give this, because this presentation comes from a very high level. So there must be also this information that goes to that level and inform that there are people who want to go to come to the party. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much for the presentation. It was quite interesting. I think most members of this portfolio comes from rural areas, and listening to especially the first part of the presentation reminded us all of what we see on the ground, but I think the challenge is how do we get past that. Just one or two questions, or maybe it's not questions, it's more comments. And hopefully this CWP program will assist with that. But one of the things that we also see in rural communities was that young women, and you did say there in your slide or presentation that young men is particularly vulnerable. Young women use the child support grant to get money, and we know that. I wouldn't say as a fact, but we see that in rural communities, and people are actually openly telling us that's why they do have children, is to get access to this grant. Is there any direct or strategy towards challenging or getting young women part of this program, and try and encourage them rather to be forming part of this program than falling pregnant to get an income, which I think is a real problem in rural areas. And then the other thing that I had is the challenge of giving the programs enough equipment. I know in certain rural areas that I visited, you see the people working in their overall daily, and it was nice to see the video, but in practice it doesn't work always like that. You will see 50 people along the road, 40 standing and 10 working, because they only have 5 wheelbarrows and 10. And I think that is what is happening in practice. I don't think we must say it's not happening. So what is the connection between that? I listened, there was something about out of the 165 is the other money being spent on the equipment, and who is responsible for that? Is that, where does that link come in? And maybe I think that is something that the rural development department can look into, because it's fine to have the workers now, but if what they must do is not available, it's not going to help us a lot. And it brings me to the monitoring of all of the work. I visited one of these programs one day in the morning. I was parking next to them and I saw them. They were busy laying pavement. In the afternoon when I got back, they were exactly at the same space. And I said to them, listen, how are you guys being monitored? You get 60 rand a day. If you do nothing or if you do something, who monitors you? And unfortunately, I think this culture that we are discussing and talking about is people are so scared that they're going to lose their job if they finish a program. That, no, you know, it's reality. People are not being given an Afrikaans. No, it's not for secret, but it's more about giving them a pat on the back or more money or something if they finish something. And I think it's part of this training process that we need to link an outcome to your responsibility. So I think it's a good start, but we need to take it slowly a bit further. And that's also coming to the next step, where what after this? Because I'm not sure what year are we in now. It could be the third year of this program, or either fourth year. We need to get people out of this program into more formalized or other jobs. And I think that is the biggest challenge that we need to do with now, because I believe that this is a good program for now, but it can't be the end of it. Must be the beginning.
Gayla, I'll give you just now. I have two questions myself. Kate, I used to work for IGT. We used to build stock dams. We used to build schools and clinics. We used to build roads and bridges, small roads and bridges in the rural areas. Three things I learned from that. The first one is that you can't successfully do these things that you were showing us in this video unless there's a training program pre and during the project. And service providers for those programs are highly expensive. And you discover that the bulk of your money that must take period to do the project gets the project short, because the bulk of the project is taken by consultants which must project manage the project and the training set providers and so on, and the tools like it was said here. That's the first thing that we learned. The second thing is the most higher skills they require. For instance, they must account for the money spent. So there has to be somebody who records how much money has been spent today, how much money is spent tomorrow, and then if there are checks, there has to be a bank reconciliation statement and so on a monthly basis. So once the person gets to that level of accounting or bookkeeping, there's a better job out there. Mm-hmm. So there's a high turnover of the higher skills, higher middle skills, than those who are trapped in that environment must stay there. Then the third one is, of course, then what the mistake says, they were there in the morning, they are still there. So supervision is the key issue. Remember that in terms of supervision, there has to be some kind of power relations imbalance. Because if all of you are at the Ikebeze Donki equal, who can give instructions to who? Those were the three critical questions that we were confronting and trying to resolve problems. Of course, then, fortunately, I was taken out of that environment in 1998 and then pushed into the Premier's office in the Eastern Cape. The worry I have, coming to your program now, the worry I have of this is that it has to be taken to scale to have an impact. And unfortunately, not all government departments are interested in getting involved in this thing. Many government departments want to fly flags, and the flags must have the emblem of the department, not the emblem of the whole state. How is it possible, I hear you come from the presidency, how is it possible that the president understands that this thing works? 89,000 people on the job for a full year is not a small feat, it's something big. Why can't we instruction throughout the government do this thing, and they must show at the end of each financial year how many people are in the job? How is it not possible for the president to give that kind of instruction? And the last one is, can't we do exactly the same thing for sustainable jobs? Because I do believe that you have Working for Water, but Working for Water is just to save water. Mm-hmm. But if you are creating game farms on the existing state game reserves, I know that in Limpopo there are people who are claiming Kruger National Park, but they can be introduced to understanding how it works in practice through this kind of program. So how can we change this instead of just, say, creating jobs, but put them into sustainable projects? I'm just sitting here seeing this window of opportunity that the government can use to create new areas. I have more fundamental ideological questions about this, but I will save them for later. But for now, whilst we're speaking about projects and jobs and saving young men from criminality, maybe let's deal with that. I've seen Honorable Gaila, and I took a chance to speak ahead of him. But then the so Mr. Nyambeganza, after Mr. Gaila. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chairperson, you about covered me on some of the points there, but Kate, the first part you were coming on nicely. The second part, let me be fair with you. You know, you were talking about this economic transfer and all, and then, you know, I think everybody was interested. Let me be fair now, because we all look forward to that, you know. Now, we are the last one. Let me be fair to you, because I'm worried about our people being locked in those two-day jobs over 100 days. Then what? After that? Then why? What is going to happen to them? You know, we've had chapters a lot of these projects, but the rich gets richer, gets tenders and all that. Then what? You know, we're talking about things being dumped on our people. You know, I thought you were going to come up with, you know, something that is solid and good for our people. You know, we stay with these people. These people are our next door neighbors, they are our relatives. We know what is happening down there. You are just talking about research, which I agree was your first part was good, but this now you say the NGOs are going to run it. What percentage are they going to get?
Service providers.
How much are they going to get? What is their percentage? Because most of these projects that most of the money goes to the service providers. Then, really, after those other days, where to then? What skills have they learned from there? Where do they move to? We're sitting with a country that totally got no skills at all. And these skills can be created. We're getting skills from outside the country. As a chairperson yesterday, when a public works committee meeting, and there is a huge demand for ordinary artisans. Ordinary artisans. There's a huge demand. We were building stadiums here. Where did the people that were building, they came from outside South Africa. So really I'd like to know then what is going to happen. You know, that's what we are interested in. Thank you.
There was a strike here at the airport. There are three companies that are running the airports. Remember those companies that bring the steps for you to get off the airplane, to take your luggage and so on. Those companies, when they experienced the strike, they were taking workers from outside South Africa to come. What we used to call a scabbing process is now legal. You can bring your workers from elsewhere to come and destroy the strike here. So that this strike does not hurt the economy. And those workers who are complaining about the wages and so on, they must just go back to work, otherwise those scams will be permanent. Now, I'm really getting concerned. Where are we going to?
Thank you, Chair. Structural inequality and the unemployed crisis. No, it's just a preamble. Let me go to CWP. Just to highlight three areas that I think need to be looked at. Okay.
Just ask me your question.
In the CWP, there are sectoral determinations in different sectors which are a product of the Department of Labor. Will you then say the wages for those 2 days or 8 days, 2 days per week, 8 days a month, do they comply with those sectoral determinations by the Department of Labor? That's one. Second, the issue of the skilling, which I think Chairperson did raise, is there a relationship in your understanding? A relationship between COPTA and CETAS in different sectors in order to skill those unemployed, in order for them to be part of the mainstream? Thirdly, the third point and the last one. I think Chair did touch on this. In Gauteng, there's what is called this non-profit agency. It's nothing else, it's a labor program. Because here is government coming up with a program saying that I want to deal with the crisis that the people that I'm leading as government, they find themselves in. But I cannot do that unless there's a middleman or woman. Then there's what is called in Gauteng Seriti, who is responsible. Yes, in
money is given to Serete Vazikop, and then Serete decides on how much each worker will get paid, including the safety clothes and the tools. They are provided by Serete, but using government money. Don't you think that government can do that, can remove Serete, and then if it's national government, the partnership between provincial and local government taking responsibility in terms of the administration of the project itself. Thank you very much, sir.
Chairperson, I think we are so disturbed that I just want to give clarity to Kate. The jobs I'm talking about, the 100 million, 1 million jobs, is not temporary jobs. It's jobs for more than 20 years. That's what I'm talking about. And when I was giving my first bite, it's been more than 20 years. And it's capital, external capital, but wanting government to come to meet them halfway and support and give them the blessing. But it is not in this presentation. This presentation just has something very disturbing.
You know, when I'm looking at ECWP, I think to me it's part of the APWP, but it's just a different term, and there are maybe differences here and there, because really if ECWP is reporting to COCTA, while on the other side we've got this APWP, which is reporting to the Department of Public Works, you know, it shows that there's a lack of integration and coordination. Then secondly, I think in yesterday's meeting there was an indication that, you know, these agencies, they don't want the 1%, so some of them are starting to pull out. This is an indication that their intention is to get profit instead of using money for the benefit of the poor. Then the other one is that the issue of realizing this CWP in local municipalities. The question that comes into my mind is that are we going to realize it? Because now some municipalities don't even understand the EPWP. That is why they are failing to access the incentive grants, because there are EPWP projects that are taking place in various municipalities. But due to the lack of understanding of what is EPWP, they fail to report so that they can access the incentive grant. So I'm worried that CWP, if we're saying CWP, we must realize it in municipalities by 2013 to 2014, is it going to be possible if we're struggling with the EPWP project? Thank you.
We do that, we are going to create the kind of model.
for people to employ themselves, to initiate enterprise, and to succeed. We cannot wait 10 years to come with interim solutions. Okay, so track number one is address structural inequality. Track number two was strategies that improve the situation within our current market context, and that included things like looking at the spread of power and value chain, looking at forms of intermediation to make your million job proposal work. That requires, that will require capacity, capital, skills, probably forms of coordination and mitigation. But what I'm saying is all of those things need to be supported. There's no question about it. And the third track is a track that says, in a context in which markets, right now, this minute, markets cannot provide employment at the scale we require. We are motivating for an employment safety net. EWC is in its document, it says this is not an employment solution. It is not. Nobody's arguing that it is.
This is not an employment solution. It is an employment safety net. And we need an employment safety net which provides a minimum level of regular employment as a safety net while we solve the bigger problems. If I was coming here presenting this as the solution to unemployment, then you could haul me out of the room. But that's not what was presented here. What was presented here was three tracks, and in those three tracks, everyone is needed. We can't just focus on the current market conditions and finding solutions without looking at the structural issues, and we have tended to do that. We can't just look at an employment safety net like CWP and ignore the need for sustainable jobs. But I would argue that we can't just look at sustainable jobs that are going to take time to deliver, and they are, unfortunately, and not put in place an employment safety net that allows people who are unemployed now the dignity of economic participation. And dignity is important. And CWP must, and any form of public employment, must represent a minimum level of decent work. And it does. And we will, you know, the engagement of the Department of Labor at that level is very important. So now let me reply quickly to some of the specific questions. The problems that were raised both over there and also by the chair, about the organization of work, the productivity of work, the skills in work. This program, let me just be quite clear, it is part of EPWP. It is a different modality, but it is an accepted part of EPWP. EPWP is a coordinating mechanism. The environmental programs report to the Department of Environmental Affairs. They don't report to DPW. The social sector programs report to DSD and Department of Health. So this one reports to COFTA. It doesn't make it different from the fact that EPWP is a coordination mechanism. This is a part of EPWP. It's a complementary part of EPWP that is meant to provide a solution to a different problem, which is the number of people exiting from EPWP back into poverty because the economy is not creating jobs at scale. This is a new component of EPWP. It's been run by government for 1 year. So yes, there are lots of implementation challenges. Part of those challenges are the issue of organization of work. The argument that we have made is to say the majority of participants at site level have often never worked before. Yes, work is not always as productive as it could and should be. Often, the team leaders, because there are, each team has a leader who works more days, gets paid more, and each group of 100 has a coordinator, so there is a structure. There is also a pay scale, so 60 rand a day is the minimum, but there are increased rates for more skilled work within the program. To answer another question there. What matters in this program is not whether sometimes you see people standing at the side of the road, and I will not deny that that happens. What matters is the trajectory. When a site starts, often you will find that work is not very well organized. The question is, over time, does work organization improve? Do work skills improve? Because that's a contribution to productivity and the economy as a whole, because people are learning the skills of work. In terms of the non-profit agencies, it's very clear. The structure of the budget is very clear. At site level, 65% of the money goes to wages. The balance covers tools, materials, health and safety equipment, and program management. And program management is fixed at 10% of the total site budget. That is a very cost-effective budget structure, and it means there's really no scope for profiteering by non-profit agencies. And that structure is fixed. In terms of where the government couldn't be doing this itself, well, the government is doing it. This is a government program. But I think that there is enormous value added by partnering with the non-profit sector in ways that builds development capacity at community level. And it's a partnership that is being forged in practice. In any partnership, there are strengths and weaknesses to that partnership. But it is working as a delivery mechanism in a context in which often government is stretched in terms of its development implementation capacity. This brings complementary skills, builds complementary skills, and offers a complementary implementation modality. In terms of training, the training is through Department of Labour. It is through the EPWP envelope for funding for training. So CWP has access to that through EPWP. And yes, through that mechanism, there is work with the teachers. The difficulty is that the demand for training so significantly exceeds the supply. And there are constraints on the training delivery side also, which are also an issue that needs to be addressed. But let me leave it there and just end by emphasizing where I started, my response to your tough questions with my tough reply, which is we have a crisis. We need to address the problem of employment at several different levels. This is one level, but we cannot ignore the need for an employment safety net while we create sustainable jobs and sustainable solutions to the unemployment crisis. And I'll leave it there.
Kate, you will work with the secretary and such as we want you back. We want to deal with the issue of the structural inequality.
Yes.
And see how best. Remember, we did not specifically say in relation to agriculture, forestry and fisheries, how do you locate this problem? We didn't say that for rural development and then before. We didn't do that for any particular program, that is right. We were just in general. So we want now to be specific, zero down, so that we can see in relation to the programs that the departments were supervising are running, in what way can this program assist? Because we know, for instance, that in particular, the rural development, when they recapitalize a project or a farm, they do so via service providers. They don't actually create a community work approach to the revitalization of the irrigation scheme. So it may be important for us to engage with your organization in a much more in-depth way so that we can deal with those matters. Also, we want to deal with the issue of the big question that you raised yourself. This crisis of inequalities and the power relations between the second and the first economy, is there somewhere where it is being dealt with? You didn't allude to one sentence that new growth path is attempting to do that. Let's get involved in that debate and see in what way rural development and land reform can be interpreted in that context as well. We're worried that we're busy providing what we call remedies or solutions to problems without the context of what the problem is. We need to deal with these things so that they are structurally impacting on the big question. Thank you, Kate. And the meeting. Oh, honorable members, we have minutes here which would not be relevant to agriculture, relevant to public works, or labor, and which rural development and land reform portfolio committee have to deal with. But if we say to you, leave now and not listen to us, the meeting won't be correct. So because you are here, we want to deal with the minutes just in 2 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee of Rural Development, you had a set of minutes of the 2nd of November circulated into your pigeonholes. We want to find out whether you have read them, and if you have read them, do they reflect the discussion in that meeting? Can I have a hand? Yes, we stay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've read them, and I've also sent Pumla a note to say that she omitted your name out of the ministry. Well, not your name, your position. So we must just include, I don't have it with me. In the first paragraph, it says, opened the welcomed. So we don't know who the was. So
I have, yes, I am captured.
I hopefully cheer you welcome.
Thank you very much.
I'm
so you move.
Move.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tava is seconding. You wanted to raise an issue, Ms. Goyamabila, because I don't want to adopt the minutes unless you have got no issue.
No, Chair, I think Honorable Stein has covered me because that is what I've noted.
Thank you very much.
Except to change the word back within municipality to conflict.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Please, we would wish the colleagues in our other committees could come again because we've got three other issues that we want to share with you, particularly the portfolio committees we've invited. The Human Rights Watch did a study on farm workers and farm dwellers. We would want to share with you what we do with that to go forward. We also have an LRC report that indicates the conflicting laws that we have passed in Parliament, all of us collectively, and we are implementing those laws, yet they are conflicting against each other. And the government is being taken to court, and government is fighting against NGOs that are taking us to court instead of fixing the laws that we have made. We want to share this with you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. The meeting is adjourned. We have a petition as well.